Hello, this is Steve Wellner from Labyrinth of the Psychonaut, and you're listening to SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
I'm talking about a big coincidence.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the holy moment. In the same way that the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's all these layers.
We think everything is separate, limited. I'm over here, you're over there, which is true. But it's not the whole truth, because we're all connected.
The time as of now is now. And you are listening to Synchronize, the weekly audio magazine exploring and highlighting the best in the synchronistic arts. Please set your minds to open.
Open the floodgate doors.
Hello, this is Alan Abadesa Green, and we have something wonderful for you today. Our featured guests are Steve Wilner from Labyrinth of the Psychonaut and Ezra Sanzerbell from Tone Color Alchemy. They've joined us to announce their new video series, Music, Myth, Cosmos. And then they play Radio 8 Ball with Andras Jones. We also have contributions from Will Morgan, who will review the film Prometheus, and David Plate, who discusses the sync film Lifehouse Matrix. But first, I want to drop something on all of you. In the first few days of 2012, I was tipped off to an obscure 1997 episode of The Outer Limits, called Music of the Spheres. This episode seemed so timely to the themes swirling around the 2012 hype that I took special notice. And it didn't hurt that the episode implied a cosmic communication from the star Sirius, which students of Tim Leary and Philip K. Dick will appreciate, whereas I have my own personal reasons to find this plot point so jaw-droppingly significant. In this Outer Limits episode, Sirius is not so subtly disguised by writing it out as Certus, but pronouncing it Cirrus. The transmission is perceived by young people of the planet as perfect music.
Isn't it beautiful?
God, Joyce, what is this?
It's music. Perfect music.
People gotta hear this.
I know. It's what the music wants.
The kid who first finds the transmission is played by Joshua Jackson, who was also in The Skulls, a movie about an elitist secret society that is a very thinly veiled reference to Skull and Bones. In this Outer Limits, he also deals with some heavy-handed Masonic imagery. If you pay close attention, at roughly 14 minutes into the episode, Joshua Jackson places a call to Japan via a Skype-like teleconference system called Handshake. Of course, the Handshake program doesn't start or load. No, the handshake is for the initiated. In Morals and Dogma, Albert Pike wrote, "The ancient astronomers saw all the great symbols of masonry in the stars. Sirius glitters in our lodges as the blazing star." And William Hutchinson said that Sirius is the first and most exalted object that demands our attention in the lodge. This episode also features Howard Hessman, most famous for playing rock DJ Dr. Johnny Fever on WKRP in Cincinnati, where we would note the theme of transmitting sound. He again plays a doctor, though this time a medical doctor, and tries to treat the mutation that is seemingly caused by listening to the music of the spheres.
You have to stop listening. The disease is starting to affect your thinking.
But what if it's not a disease? I mean, Dad, isn't it true that the only ones who've died so far are the ones we've tried to cure?
Yes.
Right, you see? The signal is not meant to harm us, only to change us. Every living thing, the more I listen to it, the more I hear that. I feel it.
But that's the endorphin effect. It's like an opiate.
No, that's just to make the change less painful. More easy to accept. Didn't Joyce even say that she was ready? Right? Deep down inside, she knew. Her body knew that it was time to change.
What kind of change?
Look. I bombarded everything on this table with high levels of ultraviolet radiation, enough to kill any normal plant or animal. The only ones that managed to survive are the ones that I exposed to the signal. We're changing. We're being changed for a reason.
Though these characters all interact with the Sirius transmission, it is only Kirsten Dunst that truly appreciates it, at least at first. Those who remember Jake Kotz's video, Yellow Flower, will recall Kirsten Dunst's sync attraction to flowers and plants, and may want to keep an ear out for all the non sequiturs where plants and flowers are mentioned in this Outer Limits. Dunst continues this attraction in her movie Cana, The Prophecy, about a girl in a giant tree, and holds flowers on the poster to the 2011 film Melancholia. Melancholia, mind you, is about Kirsten Dunst facing a blue planet hurtling towards the Earth. Now listen to this from the 1997 Outer Limits.
What are we looking at?
This is the star that our radio signal came from, as it appears in 1937. It's a yellow dwarf, much like our own sun. And this is the star as it appears today, a blue dwarf.
I don't understand.
Their sun changed.
It shifted, rather, towards the ultraviolet. And ours is about to do the same thing.
All that increased solar activity, the sunspots, they were warning signs. We didn't even see it coming.
But they did. Because it happened to them. To survive, they had to adapt, to change. And they're offering us that same choice. The music wasn't an act of war. It's an act of mercy.
We should also note that Joshua Jackson currently plays Peter Bishop in the TV show Fringe, with its share of alternate worlds colliding. However, it is not just the apocalyptic themes that make me think back to 2012. It is the fact that this episode beats you over the head with the word change. Let us then turn from media to the man who carried the torch of change into 2012, here in our alternate reality. While I feel that Barack Obama has offered no real change from the warmongering policies of George Bush, we must remember that his 2008 campaign slogan was simply the word change. Now let us consider that in his 2008 Super Tuesday speech, Barack Obama spoke of a hymn, a song, that can change the world.
We know that what began as a whisper has now swelled to a chorus that cannot be ignored, that will not be deterred, that will ring out across this land as a hymn that will heal this nation, repair this world, make this time different than all the rest.
To understand the connection between music and change, we should turn to Ezra Sanderbell's chapter in Sync Book Volume 2, where he relates musical structures to the I Ching, also known as the Book of Changes. And no conversation of 2012 would be complete without mentioning Terence McKenna's Time Wave Zero, a cyclical pattern he attributed to the structure of time and which he based off the patterns of the I Ching. This time wave can also be thought of as a sound wave, or, more explicitly, we can think of music as keeping time. In revisiting all this, it has caused me to ponder the calls from various New Age groups for us to raise our vibration. Well, what is a raised vibration but a waveform with an increased frequency? If we think of that as related to McKenna's time wave, this would be an increased frequency of the temporal pattern, a sort of quickening in the cycle. This is both a conscious and unconscious attempt to immanentize the eschaton. Now, as to how these things manifest literally, that's where people's expectations are usually not met. Which is not to say that they don't manifest. If we go back to another time where people were expecting to enter a new age of enlightenment and voted for a president that claimed to be anti-war, we can get a sense. Just as no one ascended on December 21st, 2012, and Obama has out-Nixoned Nixon, the people of the 70s didn't get to travel through Dave Bowman's Stargate and become a race of indigo children. No, they didn't get the literal Stargate they were hoping for, but they did get an Aquarian Watergate.
This is Chipper Dog from Sky Blue Symposia. You're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Up next, I interview Steve Wilner from Labyrinth of the Psychonaut and Ezra Sanderbell from Tone Color Alchemy about their new video series, Music, Myth, Cosmos. This is an Indiegogo project which you can and should support. Links to their sites and the Indiegogo page are included in the show notes at thesyncbook.com/synchronize. This interview was recorded on May 16th, 2013, one day before their campaign launched. A little birdie told me you boys are up to something, some sort of new project mixing your mutual love of music, Ezra's work in synchromusicology, and Steve's amazing video skills. Steve, can you tell us about your project?
Absolutely, Alan. We've been working for the last 6 weeks or so on a project called Music, Myth, Cosmos, which we're trying to basically take the essence of pure sound and the history of music and see how it's affected us from children and through video games and pop culture all the way up into the present day and even into the future, some sci-fi elements as well. And we're just looking at all the contributions from famous musicians and trying to analyze how it really does affect us consciously. And I'm integrating my part of it is sort of taking the synchronicities that I've done in my old YouTube videos, Labyrinth of the Psychonaut, and taking the synchronicities that I've found in relation to music and seeing how they all add up and kind of doing a free associative jazz style combination of everything that's influenced Ezra and I in our lives and seeing how they've matured to this day, basically.
Ezra, can you tell us what you're going to contribute to the project?
Sure. Well, I've been contributing a lot of different elements, and it's really a collaborative effort in the sense that Steve and I will get together and hang out in the same space, and then I'll bring some media, he brings some media, I'll bring some ideas, he has some ideas. So it's, in a way, it feels really balanced. I come from a background in music theory and music performance, so I studied that in school, and I found that there was something about the pursuit of knowledge around music that always ended with either music theory, which is basically like a mathematical deconstruction of all the elements of music into its primary parts, but it doesn't tell you anything about the spirit of music. And then, on the other hand, things like music reviews or documentaries about musicians, which goes more into the personal lives of the human beings. But there's this uncharted domain, and this is what I'm bringing to the project, is like the question of, well, what is that invisible space between the music and the performers, this mystical sub-level of reality that nobody's seeing and nobody's talking about, but that I sense is really there and that is actually responsible for why we're so moved by music. So I'm bringing that question and then just, you know, putting in the time and the effort, which is a big part of it.
Steve, maybe you can give us some more details of the project. Like, is this a new video? And how is it that people can support the project?
We're launching an Indiegogo platform, Kickstarter type fundraiser for a trailer that we put together that's about 10 minutes in length. And we also shot some live footage around Portland, Oregon, where we go into more details about what we'd like to do for future projects. And the trailer is basically a compression. Most people that have seen my videos in the past know that I like to take a bunch of media and sort of rapid fire sequence, make this very compressed wave file of all kinds of things that I've been experiencing in my own personal reality window. And so we've created this beautiful trailer that's a lot more professional than I'd say that we've ever attempted before. A lot more mature and a lot more coherent. And the voiceovers are back. There's narration. And what we'd like to do, if we raise enough funds through the Indiegogo program platform, we'd like to take that trailer of compressed ideas and sort of spread it out and expand it, just like your fingers spreading apart, and do basically a 6 to 8 video series on YouTube. Where we go into depth about each subject, so it's much more easy to understand for beginners and also not boring for people that are more advanced in the subject matter.
Ezra, crowdfunding is a fairly new trend that allows us to bring together our social networks as well as our desire to give our time and energy to the projects we support rather than funding the less desirable and more controlled artwork. Do you think that by including a more human element, the power of intention, as well as the power of choice, that crowdfunding will lead to an increase in synchronicities in and around the projects being funded?
I'm not sure if you're addressing specifically our project or just at large, which, I mean, they're both relevant, but I can only speak for what I know about my experience. And I know that Steve and I, you know, we put a lot of special care into making the Indiegogo video. We hired a videographer, and we rented costumes. We dressed up like pharaohs with these robes on, and we just really had a fun time of it. And there are certain elements of the video that we created that I was aware, oh, this could actually bring us into resonance with certain archetypes that could have impact. And, you know, as far as the larger question of what the impact of crowdsourcing is on small art groups like ourselves getting funded, I mean, from what I've seen, I've looked online and witnessed a lot of projects getting tens of thousands of dollars. I was looking at the numbers, for example, on the Soundless Dawn YouTube channel, there's 26,000 subscribers to Steve's videos. Now, I did the math, and I mean, if 15% of the viewers of Steve's videos were to actually make the lowest tier contribution of $5, we would actually exceed our goal. So it really seems like a viable option for fundraising, and we figured we may as well give it a shot and see if people want to support us.
I hope people do support you guys. Steve, a few years back, you did a podcast with Ezra talking about musicians trying to gate entities into their music. Do you think it is possible to put a positive subliminal, or however we may wish to word it, into music as well?
Yeah, absolutely, Alan. I mean, sigils and magical intent is just a reflection, an aesthetic reflection of willpower. So you can attach and manifest any type of reaction and emotion that you want. It's all the will that the musician or artist puts into their work. There's a restaurant right near my apartment called Pambiche. It's a Cuban restaurant. And he has these weird magical sigils right on the sidewalk of his restaurant. And I didn't know what to make of them the first time, so I just kind of looked at them and looked in my heart and kind of conjured and what that made me feel as an individual. And I found that they were really, really positive. They seemed to support commerce and support people going to his establishment. So in the same way, musicians can have undertones and overtones of those notions in their music. A lot of the time when, you know, musicians are bastardized as having negative, nefarious magical content in their work, like Jay-Z and Beyonce and things like that, a lot of it is the thought form of the observers and the people listening to the music and wrestling with their own inner demons. And, you know, just like a strictly in closeted Christian mentality would be afraid of a devil symbol, that kind of a thing. It's the reflection of our fears in magical constructs that enable us to go one way or the other with it, positive or negative.
A sort of follow-up question to that, Steve. You had mentioned once that you made a change. You could see the way that your videos changed over the years, where they started out with the narration and really examining a subject, and then you went into this sort of psychedelic, quick-paced phase of your work, and you mentioned the idea of putting subliminals into it. It was sort of a subliminal to help people raise their vibration or their consciousness. Are you planning on doing anything like that in this film series?
No, not in that scope, rather. I was basically toying around with the idea of having these super compressions, and it was a part of my personal process, and I did slip in a lot of subliminals, neither positive or negative to me, but like I just said in my previous example, the viewers can interpret it in much different ways, and I certainly used occult-like symbols that could be Luciferian or various looking in nature. But I feel like I'm done with that process because I really took it to the limit of where I can go with it. I feel I was trying to make these compressions so people would like download information of the images and the visuals that I put in later on. But I honestly ended up doing that and wormholing too much. So it affected me more than anybody that probably watched it. Like I would have audio and visual hallucinations afterwards, and I would get all these downloads, and it was great. It was almost like a pseudo drug for me personally. But I really don't think it's healthy for me to pursue that line, especially when there's so many other things that I'd like to get into with a lot more content to do with descriptives of music and synchronicity, where I'm using my voice and being more of an educator instead of just someone that's blasting images at people like at an electronic rave or something.
Ezra, similar question to you. I know you're a musician that you actually create music, not just examine music. Have you ever played with any of putting anything into your music in a similar way?
Yeah, I've definitely played with that. Although a lot of the music that I create, for example, on my SoundCloud account or in bands I've played with in the past, there's definitely a distinction. When I'm writing a song from my heart, there's no need to embed or encode any subliminal information. It doesn't come out that way. I just, you know, I'm fiddling around with the guitar and singing until something comes out and I record it. But I'm definitely interested in this idea. There's a guy, Francis Bacon, that was written up, you know, he's kind of a famous occultist, and he was written up in that book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. And they talked about how Bacon was actually encoding these secret messages into music based on a code that only he and the people who he had let in on the secret would be able to decipher. And that really tripped me out. And I discovered Paul Foster Case, who was a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which was this magical society in England that was very influential and powerful. And Case was a musician who included these tone color or music note and visual color tone attributions to the tarot cards, to the zodiac, to all this stuff. And I started becoming curious whether other composers, songwriters were using that actual that actual method. And it's interesting, you know, in the previous Synchronize episode, I actually took a look at Radon Chong's work and provide an example of how one could look at these subliminals through the tone color paradigm and derive meaning. Whether that's meaning that was actually scripted and placed there intentionally or not, you know, I actually have my doubts. My sense is that no, this is just sort of the case of putting on a certain type of goggles and you can see something that otherwise you wouldn't see. But whether that it was put there on purpose or not is anybody's guess.
Steve, you said that you're moving out of this phase of trying to do that. Do you think that by opening yourself up to this, what Ezra's explaining here, of just the more from the heart, or even in some cases more from the intellect, if you're going back to narration and things like that, do you think it's a sort of allows more natural synchronicities to come in?
Yeah, absolutely. The synchronicities in your life will just flourish and come out more. And if you have less and less masks in front of the art that you're presenting on the internet itself is a big mask making production machine. So by incorporating live footage, if the Indiegogo fundraiser goes well, we're going to shoot more live footage. We have our friend Timmy here, who's a great videographer. And so not only are people going to get the educational narration and the really much more mature and coherent videos that we're able to produce now as sort of not masters, but definitely people that have matured in this field for over 8 years now can produce. They're going to get that, and they're going to get the face behind it, which was I know part of what made it interesting to people was the mystery behind why when I first started, like, a 22, 24 year old guy would have all of this occult knowledge. How is it possible to is he speaking from a truth that is he speaking from a certainty and knowing? How does he have this knowing? And so I came across people that were living this lifestyle as a warrior, as Castaneda would say, for an even longer period of time than me, like Jason Horsley, who sort of just made me look at myself and like, you know, you're just a kid, you're still learning. But I do feel like being 30 years old and having done this for a long time and going through all of those steps of actualization with this process and maturing it along the way, that I do have something much more mature to say now from the heart. And Ezra always pulls me back and brings me back to center with that, because he's always very strong in the heart. So it's really a good team between us, because I do get in the head a lot more than him, and he pulls it back down to the earth and the heart. And it's that synergy really works well with these videos, I think.
As residents of Portland and as sync sleuths with an eye on the media, do you have any insights to share regarding living in a town that is now home to three popular TV series currently in production, those being Grimm, Leverage, and Portlandia? And what do you think the effect of an increased media output from this conscious community will be?
Well, I've heard people talk about Portland as an experimental zone or a temporary autonomous zone that's actually functional. So, I don't know what the effect is going to be on American culture or internationally or whatever. You know, I've definitely seen my fair share of Portlandia. I'm not familiar with the other one, Grimm, and I'm not sure what the other one you mentioned was. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's always been cultural hubs in America, whether it was New York City or San Francisco or LA or whatever, Chicago. And it seems to me like Portland is just one of those places. It's kind of this newer city in the sense it's been around for decades. People have been here and it's rooted. And yet at the same time, it's more and more coming into the mainstream. People are becoming aware of it. And so a lot of people are moving here from the U.S. You find more people who live here who are not native to Portland than native to Portland. And yeah, it's really interesting. Lots of artists out here. It's really it's a beautiful place to be stewing. And I'm really honored that Steve and I could meet up here to work on this project together.
Well, Ezra has worked with Andras Jones and Radio 8Ball in the past, and Steve, you asked Radio 8Ball a question during our live Sync in New York City event. So you're both veterans of the Radio 8Ball format. Are you ready to play again?
Sure, sounds fun.
Definitely.
Hi, this is Anya Marina, and you're listening to my synchronistic soul brother, Andras Jones, on Radio 8Ball.
Hi, guys, and welcome to this Radio 8Ball segment on Synchronize. This is the show where we answer questions, or the little game where we answer questions by picking songs at random and interpreting those randomly chosen songs as the answers to the questions, like picking musical tarot cards. And as Alan said, you both know how it works. Now, I hear you both have a question ready, and then we'll determine which one will be the actual question for the Pop Oracle.
That's correct, Andres.
Mm-hmm. So, let's start with you, Steve. What's your question for the Pop Oracle?
My question is, will the understanding of pure sound enable us to reach the stars?
Excellent. And Ezra, what's your question for the Pop Oracle?
I would like to know, what is the source? What is the secret power of music?
Okay, well, let's say that Steve's question is heads and Ezra's question is tails, and I'll flip a coin here. How about that?
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, flipping the coin, and it's heads. So we're going to go with Steve's question. Will the understanding of pure sound enable us to reach the stars?
That's right.
Excellent. So would you pick a number between 1 and 8? And I'll tell you, we're going to be doing something a little bit different here, trying a lot of new stuff on Synchronize. It's a new show. I am actually going to be stepping in as the musical guest and performing live here the song that will be the answer. I figured when you got two song shaman, I don't want to waste this on somebody who's not going to be able to enjoy it, whose music is just canned. So I'm very much looking forward to contributing the music to this. We have a list of songs numbered 1 through 8 that I sent to Alan. He has now rearranged them, so I don't know what order they're in. And then you guys can pick a number between 1 and 8, and that'll determine what song I play.
Why don't you take that one, Ez? Why don't you pick the number?
Number 7.
Alan, will you post the song list in the text feed? Song number 7 is, an old one for me. It's called Get Normal. I can't get normal. I can't get normal. You see, I'm a witness. I was at the slaughter. I saw the body. It looked like Mr. Carter. And I can't get normal. Get normal. Get normal. Get normal. With everybody looking at. Okay, what do you want? Did you come to tease or did you come to taunt? Well, get normal. Get normal, get normal, with everybody looking at you. Get normal, get normal. Oh, well, I'd like to tell you, I'd like to explain. If I could only get my tongue so far inside your ear, it scratched your brain. But I can't, I just can't do it. I can't get normal. Get normal, get normal, with everybody looking at me. Get normal, get normal.
Sorry about that. Get normal, get normal, get normal, with everybody looking at you. Get normal, get normal, get normal. Get normal, get normal, get normal, with everybody, everybody.
Thank you. That was Get Normal from my band's, the Previous, our CD from 1995, Unpop. It's the only song that's an old song that was in the set. So it's the one, strangely, it's the one that I've practiced the least. So that was kind of fun. And musically, that's the most wide-ranging song in there, so I'm very interested to see what you think about that as the answer to the question, will an understanding of pure sound enable us to reach the stars?
Wow. Well, I definitely pictured myself piloting a little spaceship when you had your little breakdown there and you're going do-do-do-do-do-do-do. I felt like that was a good background music for that. But Get Normal, I guess, the nature of pure sound is like attempting to mimic the actual voice of the original creation. I know it's grandiose sounding as hell, but Get Normal is like you have these like really high expectations of yourself to analyze and understand what that might be and how to use that to travel to the stars in our spaceships and whatnot. So I don't know. I just felt really humbled by the song. It was kind of the perfect answer in the way that there was some humor to it. And don't take yourself so seriously. But in finding out these like ultimate mysteries, perhaps the key is that it's a lot less analytical, intellectual at the end when you find the answer, and it's a lot more full of joy and fun.
That's great.
Ezra, what did you think? I'm curious what you think, because that song, I don't know if you noticed, musically, it's shifting its center constantly. It's a song that's constantly modulating. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious. I know probably you don't have time to do a full decode on it, but I'm kind of curious how those modulations might fit into your mm-hmm. experience with the tone color mm-hmm. alchemy system.
Yeah, totally. I had a few things come up. I don't have a guitar on me, so I couldn't actually follow along and like deconstruct the chords while you're playing. So I was just like listening. So a couple things that came up. First of all, something about like getting your tongue inside their ear to scratch their brain, that mm-hmm. just really got my attention. I really liked that lyric, and that I feel like in a way, you know, that's what Steve and I are doing. We're like, you know, our tongue is like communicating these words that are like entering the minds of the people who we're sharing this information with. And then also the idea that like what we're sharing is not normal, and we can't get normal. And, you know, that's actually the whole reason we're doing this. And, you know, and then also the idea that everybody's, you know, we can't get normal with everybody looking at you. One of the reasons that this project came online for me was that I had already presented myself as a public figure, having done a couple radio interviews and done blogs and written essays and whatnot. And I felt like now that I had created a certain like online identity, that I felt like I had to like redeem it, because I see that it's incomplete. And so a lot of this is like, oh man, that was this really abnormal identity structure that I projected onto the internet that's just kind of like floating there as this fragment. And I feel like there are people who see that and look at it and probably are like, what the hell is that all about? So I'm realizing I can't get normal. Everybody's looking at me. I have to just go all the way through the weirdness, which brought me into also at the end of the song, Andres, when you started singing higher, like in your falsetto, as far as like the whole idea of pure sound enabling us to reach the stars, I had this association that, you know, the abnormal sort of this shifting amorphous musical signal that keeps going from one thing to the next is in a way an expression of change, an expression of like dynamic flux. And that is the essence of pure sound. It's not a singular thing. It is constantly shape-shifting and evolving. And that's, I feel like, one of the secret powers of music is that it's not concretized. It's actually totally fluid. And so it was interesting when you shot up at the end, I had this image kind of like Steve talked about like this rocket ship like going up, or just that your falsetto was like the spaceship taking off from these changing chord progressions, like reaching the outer limits of your own range. Anyway, so I don't know what that does for you, but you know, that was just what came up for me.
Oh no, I think that's great. And it did, I knew there was something about the modulations that made sense, and you helped it make sense to me, is that it's this song that starts in this lower register and talking about sort of dark, scary things, and it is a song that never hangs on one key for, you know, more than, you know, 25 or 30 seconds of that it's, and there's something about music as modeling being able to shift between different states of consciousness, which you could think of as keys, that is, at, you know, it's like the Kubrick opening to 2001, that we're just up leveling the same impulses and the same patterns, modulating them, if you will. So where, mm-hmm. you know, a base discovery is the discovery of the bone that you can beat someone with, a higher level is to the bone that you can look at the whole world, you know, look at the whole galaxy from. I thought that was a really, for me, it was also for me personally, it was a telling answer because I'm just starting to play music again when this was something that I devoted, you know, about 15, 20 years of my life to fully, to about the being out there and performing and putting out records. And this is the opening song from probably the 100% I'm proud of record that we put out. And I have also kind of rejected, like you're saying, the previous masks. The band was called The Previous. It's funny that I call it a previous mask. But for me, the fact that the Pop Oracle chose that and that was your song, just makes me have to re-love those old parts of myself that I've been pretty consciously rejecting. The only reason that song actually ended up in the list was because I didn't want to include a cover or any other old song. So I'm just working off new stuff. So that was, for me, as far as the answer of will it take us to the stars, first it has to take us into the depths of our own selves so that then totally. We can explode out into the stars. And usually it's another musician doing this, and I always forget what a humbling and honoring experience it is to be able to contribute, to play music in the context of someone else's question. So, whew, powerful. Thanks a lot, guys.
For sure. And Andres, yeah, if I can just jump in, I wanted to add one more thing that came up when you were sharing, Andres, that's you mentioned like, oh, in order for us to reach the stars, we have to set our roots down into the earth or something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing. But that's really kind of an interesting thing for like Steve's question, that understanding of pure sound, the idea of that at the center of our planet, there's this thing called the Schumann resonance, or this pure radiant tone that's resonating through our whole planet. So I'm wondering if we reached our roots all the way deep into the earth, into the past, you know, the earth is basically decomposed matter. So it's that which we consider to be dead, but which is actually still living as our planet. If we go all the way to the center of that, we find pure sound, the Schumann resonance. And that actually is that source of power that will then allow us to launch up into the stars.
As below, so above.
Right.
If I may come in here for a moment, I just want to share a few things that I was thinking about. It wasn't so much an answer to the question, but the sort of the themes of what we've been talking about. Steve mentioned the idea of a more mature approach to all the stuff that we've been developing over all these years, and now finally feeling like, okay, I get to come back, kind of do an overview of what have I learned, or now that I'm more mature, I can kind of take this from a different perspective. It almost seemed like getting normal in the most literal sense, was this idea of maturing. There's the idea Andras asked about the different modulations. Well, there was also the comment about how Ezra and Steve are a good counterbalance to each other, where one's more head, one's more heart, one, you know, different skill sets and things like that. One's more visual, one's more audio. And the idea that this creates this balance, well, the song I felt like did that in there. And then there's this other association I had in my mind is I introduced you, Andras, with the question you contributed about Portland and all that, then saying, well, you're also from the Pacific Northwest. And as you were singing Get Normal, all I could think of was Normal, the marijuana legalization organization, which is, of course, happening in the Pacific Northwest.
Also, it's Keep Portland Weird, right? Not normal.
I don't know if they'll have that reference point, but there's signs all over Portland that say Keep Portland Weird.
There's the same here in Asheville, and I think there's the same in Austin. There's a few, like, cities that have owned their weirdness, right?
Thank God.
It's funny. In Olympia, we don't need the sign. I like to point out to people that Olympia is the IA in Portlandia. That a lot of the people who make Portlandia, you know, were Olympians who left Olympia to go to Portland. And when I watch that show, I always think they're really making fun of Olympia as much, if not more, than they're making fun of Portland. Because I guess because the parody of Portland would be Olympia. We already are the parody. Like, they don't have to parody us. We already are putting birds on things and calling them art and worrying about where the chicken was raised and taking those questions very seriously. It makes for an interesting place to live.
Yeah, definitely. I get the reference you're making to the Portlandia show. It's one of the first ones I ever saw. And I haven't been to Olympia, so I can't comment on that. But yeah, I love it here. To me, it doesn't even feel weird. It feels like the whole world is weird, and Portland is like one of the few sane hubs on the planet. But, you know, I'm kind of a weird guy, so what can I say?
Well, wouldn't that be the essence of getting normal if everyone else is crazy? You know, what we think of as weird is actually normal. And it's okay to be this fucking crazy.
We would like to thank Steve Wilner and Ezra Sanzerbell for joining us on Synchronize. Please check out their Indiegogo page, and if it is within your ability, please support their effort. Remember, links to their sites and the Indiegogo page are included in the show notes at thesyncbook.com/synchronize. Up next, we have an audio essay from Will Morgan, co-host of the Syncbook radio show, 42 Minutes.
No radio, no heat source. Nobody's home.
There is nothing in the desert. And no man needs nothing.
What was that?
Just something from a film I like.
The key to my understanding of the Prometheus puzzle was Alan Ebedessa Green's book, Look at All the Happy Creatures. He begins the book with a retelling of the Prometheus legend. When I read this section, it completed a series of 3 Prometheus sinks in a matter of days. When this happens, a sinkhead takes notice. From the book.
Prometheus overcame his emotions and steeled himself for the task at hand. He spoke sharply, with an air of finality. You have freed me. As per our agreement, I will extend to you a gift more powerful than the atomic bomb. And so he did.
I mean, this is how it strikes me. Our technological progress is fraught with heavy metaphysical implications. Like Nobel's dynamite, human progress is more than a duality, encompassing the full spectrum of darkness and light. And which brings us to Ridley Scott's recently released Alien prequel, Prometheus. I mean, Prometheus's visuals are hypnotic and its story compelling. Our focus, however, is not on the surface images or even the story, but on the deeper currents embedded in the film. Perhaps, as I did, you noticed a Rubik's Cube making an appearance on screen at the beginning of the film. This signifies that the game has begun and the riddle is in play. A game that, in my opinion, hinges on the question that most everyone I've talked to about the flick ask right away.
I don't get it. Why did the robot put the crap in that dude's drink?
They are referring, of course, to the character of David, an android played by Michael Fassbender, who puts a black tarsh liquid into a drink consumed by Logan Marshall Green, who plays Dr. Holloway. Most of the time, I simply answer this question, to get the redhead pregnant. But there's more to it than that. Michael Fassbender's composite character, including a sex addict in Shame, his role as Carl Jung in David Cronenberg's Dangerous Method, and his appearance as a symbol of animal magnetism in X-Men First Class, all of which came out in 2011, give us a hint as to why he becomes Death's midwife in Prometheus. To understand David's motivations, we have to pay attention to what his character holds in high regard. In Prometheus, David is seen viewing Lawrence of Arabia and quoting it numerous times. He even dyes his hair so that he will resemble a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Peter O'Toole. You may recall Fassbender's role in the highly sink-worthy Dangerous Method, which tuned in on Jung's Aryan roots in contrast with Sigmund Freud's Jewish heritage. It's an intriguing sink to find Fassbender's droid trying to mimic the master race in order to gain favor with the giant alien engineers in their Ganesh-like alien suits. Also noteworthy, Lawrence of Arabia was re-released in both the years 1991 and 2003. I'll remind you that 91 and 03 were both the years that the United States invaded Iraq. And here we click one more side of the Rubik's Cube into full color. Suddenly, the black oil-filled vases of mass destruction take on a whole new meaning. Is Ridley Scott using Prometheus as political editorial? Or is Synchronicity using Scott and his fanciful production to give voice to deeper human insecurities?
Oh! It damn well hurts.
Certainly it hurts.
Well, what's the trick then?
The trick, William Potter, is not minding that it hurts.
The trick, William Potter, is not minding that it hurts.
I'm Jake Kotze, and you're listening to Synchronize on SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
And now, David Plate, one of the co-hosts of the SyncBook Radio show Always Record, talks about a media mashup called Lifehouse Matrix, which you can watch on Andras Jones' YouTube page, linked up in the show notes at thesyncbook.com/synchronize.
I recently had the pleasure of visiting the Lifehouse Matrix, an epic modern interactive rock opera discovered by Andras Jones, who had the wherewithal not only to replicate an album that was never technically released, but to play this album over the film that resonates the album's themes most directly. After Tommy, the Who had planned on creating another rock opera called Lifehouse, though this one was to be very different in its approach. Quoting Wiki speaking to the Lifehouse method, Townshend originally intended Lifehouse as a multimedia audience participation musical production to follow The Who's Tommy. Difficulties in funding and implementing the project led to its release as The Who's highly successful album Who's Next instead. Although some of the key Lifehouse songs were left off Who's Next, the basic concept of the opus is still recognizable within the album. In Lifehouse, Townshend predicted a future wherein the population was forced inside by heavy pollution and connected in their homes to an internet-like grid, through which media modules provided programmed entertainment. Rebels escaped the situation and gathered together to perform a live musical concert which generated a Nirvana-like state of universal unity. Townshend hoped to leak the audience in a way that would reflect the personalities of the audience members. To do this, he adapted VCS3 and ARP synthesizers and a quadraphonic PA to create a machine capable of generating and combining personal music themes written from computerized biographical data. He expected these thematic components would merge to form a one-note or universal chord, representing the audience and, by extrapolation, all of humanity. The amount of genuine synchronicities that show up throughout the alignment of a Lifehouse Matrix is truly uncanny. I could never give them complete justice here in analyzing them out loud, the experience being the thing in itself, though I can say, after having attempted hundreds of album movie syncs over the years, and only stumbling upon a very select few that I really can't explain, I place this one very high on that list. Legend has it that those who attended concerts of The Who in the band's golden era commonly reported having a truly spiritual, even religious, experience. Indeed, there is something special about what this band was able to communicate and bring out in the listener, while encouraging and providing a space for awakening from the bonds of the consensus illusion we project between ourselves and each other. It is especially reconciling for those indoctrinated with Christianity to take in their liberative viewpoint of this religion. This is overtly incorporated into the lyrics of many of their songs. Their classic rock opera Tommy was layered heavily with Rosicrucian symbolism, and it is my understanding that it is itself a metaphor for the foundation of this particular school of esoterica. The sync wink by Sam Mendes to Dr. Bill and Alice of Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, along with Pete Townshend in the credits of the film American Beauty, could point to this as well. Much like Pink Floyd's classic film The Wall, The Who's Tommy appears to encourage this same type of synchronistic overlay, being that Tommy is essentially their own album played over a film. Though it leans more towards being a musical in certain ways, it does reflect the same energetic to a high degree. The point is that The Who, like Pink Floyd, creates a cinematic-type story in their albums and even suggests a ceremony of sorts with its religious overtone. The film The Matrix had a large impact on audiences, and has without question created a following that is similar to that of The Who's in many ways. The Matrix communicated something for people who often would not necessarily be exposed to such concepts otherwise, while those who are familiar are drawn to look still deeper into the occult layers of philosophical Easter eggs that the film provides. For example, I must have seen the film 14 times before it was that I noticed that when Neo is sitting on the floor of the Oracle's waiting room, the television set behind the child levitating cubes is playing Night of the Lepus. It took Kevin Halcott pointing out, then, that the Lepus constellation was taken by the ancient Egyptians to be the boat that the dog god Anubis/Sirius led the soul through the underworld to be judged through the weighing of the heart against that of a feather. One commonality between The Matrix and The Who's rock operas is that they were both not only acknowledging, but adamant about stressing that after awakening or enlightenment, the tests and trials do not cease. Liberation itself is not an end, but a beginning. It is what one does with oneself after the fact that is highly focused on. The band in the plot of Lifehouse is the band we are listening to. Not only that, the album is the concert. In other words, you are in the story, watching yourself. The intention is to create or discover an underlying double torus of sorts. This is the essential question posed by the mystics. Who am I? Another point that said album and film emphasize is the idea of recycling symbolism and recognizing how this tendency stretches to all areas of our personal lives, as well as in business and politics. More overtly, in the lyrics, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, but this idea tends to be repeatedly emphasized. While The Matrix is itself a new mythos or song, with just a few new lines, so to speak, Neo is the solar deity playing out an all-too-familiar story. For me, the film carries an air of 2001 A Space Odyssey, in that The Matrix is likened to a television set, so by watching it, you are symbolically plugging yourself into The Matrix, while the monolith of 2001 is made to represent the screen on which you are viewing. After making this connection, I found it amusing that many of the songs meant to be on Lifehouse ended up on Who's Next, which pictures the band pissing on a structure similar to that of the monolith. Could this be a statement on how they feel towards the monomyth? It does seem as though they related to their work as a contribution to the great work, which can only be called such truly if one has extricated oneself from the limitations of the senses and is able to look back upon looking, so to speak. Not that which the eyes see, but that by which the eyes can see, as it says in the Upanishads. I couldn't help but have a sense throughout the film that 9/11 was being pointed to, at least what its symbolism represented archetypally. It could be argued that if you are looking for something, you will find that thing everywhere. But it is difficult to write off something like Neo's passport expiration being September 11, 2001. So when The Who sings the lines, "Before I walk on water, lay your money down," it can't help but remind me of Jesus in the Gospel turning over the money changers in a fit of rage, especially in view of the World Trade Center having been symbolic of the temple, as has been demonstrated extensively by Jake Kotza, among others. Seeing how all is connected feels to be the meaning of Neo, the One. So when The Who poses the question, "Who are you?", the One becomes quite possibly the most rational answer.
Thanks, David. Andras here. For those unaware of David Plait's work in the field of sync films, I encourage you to check out his blog, Being There 723. David is a master of the format that Lifehouse Matrix is my not-so-humble contribution to, and you'll be hearing more from and about him in future Synchronize episodes. I just wanted to take a moment here to track a few potent personal synchronicities that emerged during the creation of this podcast. For one thing, Ray Manzarek of The Doors just died. Considering the musical theme of this week's show, the passing of such a critical figure in what was arguably the most brazenly shamanic Western pop band of all time is certainly auspicious. Beyond that, I find it interesting that Ezra and Steve got my song Get Normal as their Radio 8 Ball answer. This was the opening track for my band The Previous' 1996 release Unpop, an album that was my own attempt at a Townsendian pop opera. I even named the title character Dennis Bland, which is an inside reference to Peter Dennis Blandsford Townsend's middle name. Then we have this nifty little bit of time sinkage with David Plait viewing Lifehouse Matrix on May 18th, the 33rd anniversary of Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980, a date which this year coincided with the tornadoes in Oklahoma City. As I'm sure the tornadoes will be for the children on the outskirts of their path, the eruption of Mount St. Helens was a defining moment of my youth, and this event is represented prominently in the artwork for Unpop, serving as a metaphor for pent-up teen angst on tilt that is the theme of the album, as well as much of The Who's catalog. With all this in mind, I suppose it's my obligation to warn listeners that this episode may have an explosive effect. Our hope is that it's an explosion of inspiration, but even that kind of explosion can blow your doors right off their hinges.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Synchronize. If you enjoyed this program, visit thesyncbook.com, where you can find archives of all the Syncbook radio shows, subscribe on iTunes,
donate to keep the shows going, and find links to all our guests' websites. We also have two other weekly shows, 42 Minutes, which airs every Tuesday, and Always Record, which airs every Thursday. At thesyncbook.com, you can find both of these podcasts, as well as links to purchase copies of the Sync books. If you get your Sync books from Amazon, be sure to leave a review there. Amazon reviews help people find our work and helps get the word out. Please share these episodes with your friends and like the Sync book on Facebook. Thanks again to all our contributors and guests, and thanks to all the listeners.
Into the big sleep. I want you here. I want to hear the scream of the butterfly. Come back, baby, back into my arms. We're getting tired of hanging around. Waiting around with our heads to the ground. I hear a very gentle sound. Very near, yet very far. Very soft and very clear. Come today, babe, come today. What have they done to the earth? What have they done to our fair sister? Ravaged and plundered, ripped her in bit her, stuck her with knives in the side of the dawn, and tied her with fences and dragged her down. I hear a very gentle sound. With your ear down to the ground. We want the world and we want it. Over here. the music's over.